Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter planned for the presidency like no other candidate before him. He was careful in his strategy. He was well organized in his approach, more methodical perhaps, I think, than anyone else. He even used his lack of name recognition to an advantage, coming out with buttons that said, "Jimmy who?" until eventually the whole country knew who Jimmy Carter was, and he was catapulted from really a lack of name recognition to become the 39th president of the United States, as in 1976 he defeated Gerald Ford for the White House. Now last year, Pat Robertson took a similar approach. In fact, some would say he was even a better planner, that his strategy, that his approach from the Iowa caucuses to the Southeastern State Super Tuesday primaries was the best ever. However, he did not win the nomination of his party, nor did he win, of course, the general election, for George Bush got both and became the 41st president of the United States. So apparently, there is more to the outcomes of life than careful planning. But you already knew that. You knew that from personal experience and not just from presidential observation. You know that because you yourself and lots of others around all of us have had all kinds of plans for education and for career, for marriage and for children and for houses and for years and for days and all the other things, some of which have turned out triumphantly and others of which have turned out tragically. And we have wondered why we have not had control in order to make our plans and our dreams come true. It's hard to understand. It's hard to understand why for one person at one time it goes one way and another time another way, or at the same time for two different individuals who seem to plan with equal diligence that they end up with such opposite results. Hard to understand and perhaps impossible to explain. Some call it luck. One was lucky and one was not. Others call it fate, more philosophic, in saying that there is a social determinism. It's a matter of things far beyond our control and our understanding. But it is the Bible that gives the best of all the answers. In Proverbs 19:21, saying, "Many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails." It's a wonderful proverb, although it's a frightening proverb, for it has high potential in its truth to both comfort us and to distress us as well. Human plans, well, the Bible teaches, there's no doubt about it, that planning is a smart thing to do. Proverbs 21:5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead to profit as surely as haste leads to poverty." Oh, occasionally we reach some even with religious conviction and persuasion, who say that planning is inappropriate. It is unresponsive to God. It takes the spontaneity out of life. And yet there's a sense in which planning is simply thinking, and there are no advocates of a lack of thinking. Obviously, we ought to think. It's just thinking about what we are going to do. It's anticipating. It's thinking toward the future. IBM has adopted think as something of a strategic statement for the company and actually produces signs, and IBMers are well aware that that is a corporate strategy as well as an individual exhortation. As Christians, we know that God thinks. The Bible is full of the thoughts of God, and that God plans. So we have, for example, prophecy, where unveiled for us is at least a glimpse of what the future will hold, saying that God has thought it through, that he has planned what is ahead. And we know that the Bible teaches that we as human beings are created in the image of God, and so we must conclude that we also are to think and that we also are to plan. And what type of planning? Well, you know the list as well as I. There's time planning. It's what you want to schedule for this afternoon and for tonight. What's planned for this next week in terms of places to go and things to do. It's planning for the next year and maybe for the rest of life, sort of charting a course of what is to be accomplished and how it's to be done. There is career planning, especially for the young, who say, "I've got to figure out who I am, what are my abilities and skills, what are the resources that I have available, and how do I put that together with the job market and with my own need for fulfillment and satisfaction and plan a career that will meet all the needs and provide for a livelihood as well." And then, of course, there's the recent popularity of financial planning, and people who make a career of helping us to plan for getting out of debt and getting into savings and planning for retirement and all the other things that are involved in taking care of our finances and our material resources. And there's spiritual planning. That's not as common an expression, but it refers to everything from salvation in Jesus Christ, the initial contract that we have with God in a commitment to Him as our Savior and Lord, all the way through the steps of discipleship as we become more and more like Jesus Christ in preparation for spending eternity with Him in heaven. All planning. And you've heard all that. But let me tell you again, to be smart, to be a planner, to don't be one of those shoot-from-the-hip type of people who simply react to everything that's happening, have no thoughts as to the future. We're to use the smarts that God has given to us. We are to be thinkers and we are to be planners. Planning is smart, but not all plans are good. I have a brother, Roy, who is very bright, very capable, and a very good planner, very good at executing plans in lots of different ways. It was several years ago that he was a speaker at a small church in a rural part of Maine and was entertained at the home of two elderly single women who were fine cooks and meticulous housekeepers. So there were only the three of them at dinner, and they provided for him a fine meal and then put before him a dessert that, for reasons that I have forgotten, he didn't want to eat. And it was either something he didn't like or he'd had enough to eat already or whatever the reason was. And so he began to think and to plan on how to get out of this. And he didn't want to be discourteous. He didn't want to be rude in any way. And he observed two things. One was that on occasion in the course of the meal, both of his hostesses would get up at the same time and they would carry dishes or other things into the kitchen or go and get something. So there were times when he was left alone at the dining room table. He also observed that there was directly behind him a window. And so his plan was that at the next occasion when they would leave, he would get the dish and, of course, hold on to it, but as quickly and inconspicuously as possible, flick the dessert out the window. And he controlled the conversation sufficiently and picked at the food long enough to stall until eventually they did get up and they did leave. And so he went through with executing his plan, took the dish with the dessert and flicked it. Now, remember I mentioned they were meticulous housekeepers? It seems that the window was very clean but not closed. or rather, that it was closed. And, well, he had a plan. He had a plan, but it wasn't a good plan. So let's not assume that just because we have a plan that that always means that it's going to work out the way, you know, that it's supposed to. By the way, I want you to remember the point of the story and not just the story. So the Bible tells us in order to make a plan good, we should get wise counsel. Proverbs 15:22 says, plans fail, maybe seemingly good plans, fail for lack of counsel. But with many advisors, they succeed. It's saying that asking the help and the counsel, the wisdom of others, is a smart thing to do. Although many of us are reluctant to do that. We in America place a high premium on independence, and we don't want to be dependent upon other people. And so we don't want to ask their advice. We don't want to seek their counsel. We don't always appreciate having a multitude of advisors in order to succeed. Several years ago, Charlene and I were scheduled to fly out of Kennedy Airport in New York City en route to Africa, and we had made arrangements for our transportation about 50 miles from where we were staying. Through Manhattan and out into Long Island and to Kennedy Airport. It was about 10 miles into the trip that we discovered that our driver didn't know how to get there. And we went through the Lincoln Tunnel and into Manhattan, and that was really about as far as he knew. He had a general notion of which direction to go and began sort of driving the streets of New York looking for Kennedy Airport. And the time is ticking off, and it's an international flight, and usually they don't wait for us. I don't know if they wait for you, but we knew that they were going to go. And the most difficult part of all was he didn't want to ask anybody directions. He was going to find it himself. He would figure it out. Well, about an hour later, when we were lost in some residential part of Brooklyn, he suggested that we instead get a taxi. And let me tell you, there aren't taxis in residential parts of Brooklyn, so that wasn't a choice we had. I, We finally did make it there. I think we followed planes, actually. You know, you look overhead and they're going that direction. You figure there's got to be an airport there. But that's not the best general approach to finding an airport. Unfortunately, there are many people who live life like this. They won't ask anybody directions. And so they live all of life going down busy streets or into residential areas or into some rural hinterland trying to find their way or looking for airplanes to follow, often missing out on the appointments of life that God would have for them. It's a tragic and a foolish thing. The same principle applies to health insurance companies that, especially in recent years, have mandated that there needs to be a second or maybe a third opinion before non-emergency surgery takes place. That is not to indict the diagnosis or the recommendation of the initial physician. It's simply to say that there is counsel and wisdom, that there can be plans, but that the plans are going to be better when you get additional advice. It's seeking the perspective of someone else. We here at Woodhill Church, in our process of preparing people for marriage, have on our procedure and in the questions that we ask in the premarital data about what other people think of the couple, of what their relationship is, of the prospect of their getting married. Not that they make the decision, but you learn a great deal when you find out what parents think or what friends think or coworkers. And if everyone's very enthusiastic about it and says, well, you have a marvelous relationship together, that's at least one more indicator that's in a positive direction. On the other side, if there are people who are distressed about it and say that's not a good matchup and we're concerned about this and that, it may not mean that a couple shouldn't get married, but it is an additional advice or additional perspective that is added. All of this is wonderful and practical direction from Scripture to plan. And as we do, to get wise counsel from others. But we must not make the enormous error of thinking that human plans are final. That just because we plan it, that that's the way it's going to be, or that's the way it should be. For you see, in the equation that makes for the reality of life, there is an enormous factor that is God. Far more significant and far more powerful than all of the other factors that we bring into the equation. Back to Proverbs 19:21. Many are the plans in a man's heart. And that's good. There ought to be many plans in a man's heart. But it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. It's the divine plan that God knows what he intends to have happen. Understand that he is a superb planner. God knows exactly what he wants to happen and how he wants it to happen, and he figures out all of the contingencies to incorporate into his plan. If you remember your own childhood, or if you are a parent and recall the frequent comments of your children in growing up years, you know that one of the first complete sentences that any American child ever learns is, I didn't do it on purpose. It's really a wonderful statement, and I don't know how they figure out the syntax and the grammar, but they do at a very young age. So you can walk into the kitchen, for example, one day, as your son is putting a live frog down a revolving garbage disposal, and you say, what do you think you're doing? And as the frog goes round and round, he looks at you and with absolute conviction and innocence says, I didn't do it on purpose. Or you say to your daughter, what were you thinking about when you called that number on the television screen and phoned California and ordered $500 worth of compact discs? I mean, what were you doing? And she says to you, I didn't do it on purpose. I mean, I just don't know. I started pushing buttons and I got these feelings. You know, I just happened. I didn't do it on purpose. Well, God never makes that statement, ever. God never says, I didn't do it on purpose. Because everything God does, he does on purpose. Psalm 33:11 says, the plans of the Lord stand forever, the purpose of his heart through all generations. That doesn't mean that we know. In fact, most of the details of God's plans and God's purpose, we know nothing about at all. That often frustrates us. Often we would like to know what's tomorrow or what's next week, what's ahead, what's going to happen. And there are moments when we think that God has somehow deprived us of the information that we ought have when he doesn't tell us. Although the truth of it is that that may be one of the greatest evidences of God's grace that there is. Take, for example, when we're going to die. I know people that have gone to mediums who look into their crystal balls or try to read their tarot cards or their tea leaves and will say to someone, you're going to live to a certain age and you're going to die in such a way. God doesn't give us that kind of information. If we knew today that we're going to live for 50 or 100 years from now, we would think ourselves invincible. And I suggest that we might live terribly corrupt lives as a result, because we would think that there was an impossibility that anyone could touch us and take our lives away. Or if we discovered, which in fact may be the case, that there is one of us or a few of us who tragically and unexpectedly will have life come to an end today or tomorrow. It's probably just as well that God withholds that information from us, for it would add a despair and a misery instead of perhaps a present joy to the life and the relationships that we have. So God doesn't tell us that kind of stuff. The future, in terms of his plans, is there, but he doesn't tell us. Although he does tell us in his Bible all kinds of information about how we are to live. Whether it's for 50 or 100 years or for a few more hours or one more day, we are told all kinds of things about the relationships that we're to have, what we're to think of God, how we're to have a relationship with him, matters of honesty and dishonesty, matters of sexual purity and impurity, how we're to handle finances, how we're to tell the truth, how we're to do all kinds of things. The way we're to live, God speaks to voluminously. But the revelation of his plans, he has often simply not told to us. Now, there's both a wonder and a frustration to the plans and the purposes of God. A wonder that he can put all of the pieces together and that he can make everything come out right. I listen to this morning's news. I read today's paper. What's happening in Beijing, where armored personnel carriers are crushing out the lives of Chinese students, where weapons are being used in Beijing to kill students, some say by the hundreds. And then read on the same front page that the Ayatollah Khomeini has died, and there's a great deal of uncertainty of what that means for the future of Iran and the future of that part of the world. And then I wonder, how do those things possibly relate to each other? And how does God fit that together with me and with you? And yet he does. It's an astonishing thing. There's a wonder to that. There's also a frustration to it. Because we live not primarily in terms of what happens in Beijing or Tehran, but we live primarily in terms of our own thoughts and our own lives. We struggle with how our piece of life fits in with all of these other things that are happening. And yet with that, we also find a comfort that God is able to put the pieces together in the puzzle, whether they be large or whether they be small. Outside of my study window, down the hall in this building, I can see the construction that's going on in the worship center. It's a fascinating thing. I see when the carpenters are there or when the block layers come, watch as the steel workers are present and as the earth-moving equipment goes about, all of the different parts that try to put the pieces together. I hear some information about it, that some of those steel beams that are going up weigh upwards to 40,000 pounds as they are lifted by a 250-foot crane. I see that there are steel workers who ride those pieces up. I mean, I'm serious. I look out the window like this, and sort of, you know, so I can look through my fingers. And that way, in case my eyes can't close fast enough, my fingers can. And if that's not bad enough, when they ride it all the way to the top, 50, 60, 70 feet, then they walk to the other end of the beam as if they're walking down a sidewalk. I observe all that. I drive up in the morning, and I see the steel going up and the shape of the building taking place. And I wonder with all the traffic, there are thousands of people who go by here on Shady Oak Road and Highway 212, I wonder of those who observe it, what they think, because there's no sign that explains what's being built. You can't really tell from the shape quite yet what it's going to be or what it's going to look like. I wonder what they imagine. And then I'm told that there's somebody who's putting all this together, all the pieces. There's a construction office, a trailer out here, and there's a superintendent there. I've not met him. In fact, I'm simply told that he is the one who coordinates all of these things, that he's the one that tells the block layers when they can lay block, when they come and when they go, and when the carpenters are to do what they're to do, and make sure that the crane is here on the right days and that the pieces are put together in the right sequence. He coordinates it all. He makes some people wait, and he makes other people hurry up. all of the things so that the final plans that he has laid out in intricate detail will come together into the final and the last project. Now, I compare all of that to life. That the God that we cannot see is in not a construction trailer, but in his heaven. That he has elaborate, detailed plans that fit in with his purpose of the way all of history is going to come together. And there are times when we look at it and cannot even figure out what it's going to be or what it's going to look like. We don't understand sometimes when we're told to hurry up or when we're told to slow down. We can't figure out how our part fits in with everybody else's part. And we sometimes have to gasp our breath as we see how other people are doing what they're doing in the masterpiece of God. We have, maybe at best, a page that's out of the blueprints, our page, but it's incomplete. It may be tattered and torn. There may be blanks that have not been filled in. But we have a conviction that God is there and that his purposes are true and that he will make his purposes happen. That is called God's sovereignty, not a common word in our English democratic language and system. For we think not typically of regal sovereignty. We think more of democratic independence. But God says in Isaiah 46:10, I will do all that I please. In other words, his purpose happens. He does it. The big issue, of course, arises when God's purpose and our plans differ. That puts us in competition with our planning in our hearts against the absolute sovereignty of God. And lest you have any question as to who wins out, let me read to you from a few of the Proverbs. Proverbs 21:30 says, there is no wisdom, no insight, no plan that can succeed against the Lord. Proverbs 16:9, in his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. Or I think as bluntly as the Bible ever says it, not in a proverb, but from the prophet Isaiah 14:24. As I have planned, God says, so it will be. As I have purposed, so it will stand. Now, God may often let us do our own thing, but eventually, his purpose will prevail. In the course of construction out here on this project this winter, one of the jobs that was done was putting tar on the outside of the foundation, the lower level of the building. And after the tar was put on, pieces of insulation were stuck to it. I don't understand all the details of this, except to say that it didn't stick or somehow something went wrong. Now, the workers that were involved in it in very cold weather finished that, and it's been idle ever since now, several months as we've come into the warm weather. But I understand that the superintendent and others have rejected that, and it's going to have to be done over again. What's there is going to have to be torn off, and it's going to have to be fixed. And so it is also sometimes with life that God allows us to go down a path for a while that may be incorrect, but eventually he makes sure that all the pieces do fit together for the plan that he has purposed from the very beginning. A few years back, Charlene and I were visiting with the Wycliffe people in Loma Linda in Colombia, South America. We had lunch one day with a couple, and the woman told just a fascinating story. She explained that she had been a Christian for some time and that she sensed God's call to missionary service and that she absolutely did not want to become a missionary. And so she set out to deliberately sin against God and defy the clear teaching of Scripture. Although the Bible forbids a Christian to marry a non-Christian, she set out to find a non-Christian man in order to marry him, so that that would be her guarantee that she would never go into missionary service. And she did it. And I assure you, I don't condone or in any way want to communicate any favor to what she did. I think it was a foolish and a sinful thing. Well, what she didn't quite count on was God's greater purpose for her husband, quite independent of her. Heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, accepted Jesus Christ as his personal Savior, and decided to become a missionary to South America. How does the proverb go? Many are the plans of a man's or a woman's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. In a few minutes, we're going to walk out of here. What are we going to do with this? Are we going to be the wiser because of this proverb? Are we going to live any differently? Well, I give you two words on how we ought to be different. Perspective and prayer. perspective, that we seek the perspective of God. Should we plan? Absolutely. The Bible teaches that we ought. Should we seek the counsel of others? We better. But always understand that our plans must fit God's purpose. Adopt that perspective. And prayer, let's decide that we're going to forsake what I think is a rather typical American Christian approach to prayer. And that is that we close our eyes and we talk to God and try to persuade God to conform His purpose to our plans. That is absolute foolishness. The purpose of prayer is never to conform God to us. The purpose of prayer is always to conform us to God. And so, if we adopt the perspective, our prayers then ought say, God, conform my plans to your purpose. Or as one more proverb says in Proverbs 16:3, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and then your plans will succeed.